This is Mountain News and World Report, WMMT's weekly sojourn into life in Central Appalachia. We now invite you to join us for a visit with folks you may or may not know, items of interest to us all, and shining moments in our living history.
Hey there, and welcome to Mountain News. I'm your host, Marley Green. In this episode, we bring you stories that center around the land we live on and how we craft healthy lives for our families and communities on that land. First, from the archives, we'll hear a delightful story produced during AppleShop's Youth Media Training and Leadership Program, the Appalachian Media Institute. During the 2009 AMI Audio Lab, Sarah Kraft recorded her family on hog killing day.
One chilly Saturday morning last November, me, my dad, and my brother got up at the crack of dawn and met up with my aunt and her family and some neighbors down at the barn. Tubs of water were beginning to boil on a wide open fire. We were getting ready to kill some hogs.
Right here, Mike.
Killing hogs has been a tradition in my family for generations.
Don't shoot him down the nose now.
I nearly did that one.
Get him high enough.
Yeah.
I'm Geneva Kraft. I'm 77 years old. Every year we killed a hog. Well, one time I was going to watch. They was going to let me go out and watch. I was the oldest girl, so I had to take care of the house inside, children. And I wanted to go out and watch them kill a hog. This man that was killing them, he was cross-eyed. When he started to shoot the hog, I thought he was looking at me. And I took off and ran back in the house. I said, I'm not going out there anymore. He's looking straight at me. And everybody got a big laugh out of it because I thought he was going to kill me.
To some people, killing animals seems barbaric. But as a girl born and raised in southeastern Kentucky, it has been a natural part of my life and of my family's. Everyone from my grandma to my dad to my 7-year-old cousin sees it as a necessary and valuable part of our heritage.
Old people tell you everything's used in a hog except squeal. People eat the feet, the ears, the tail. They take the head and make what they call souse. They take the intestines and make chicklings. They render lard. You get the ham and shoulders. You got your salt pork. You make sausage. So basically everything is used on a pig except the squeal.
Hi, my name is Rena Austin, and I'm 7 years old. And on Saturday, I watched them kill pigs. When it started going oink, oink, I kind of got grossed out. But then I hid behind my mom. And I didn't know what to think about it. I wasn't there when they killed the other pig, but we had two, and I kind of saw the other pig's guts.
So, Dad, how do you actually kill a pig?
First thing, the most important thing, is you don't feed or water the pig or hog before you kill it. Next step is you have to shoot it, and most people use a 22. 22 will kill it. Then you have to stab it, which is you stick a long pointed knife into its neck, and you need to cut or break the artery to make it bleed. It needs to bleed out before you need to scrape it. Some people scrape hogs. Now, I've got to where I do now. I skin them like you skin a deer. It's a lot easier. It's quicker. But most people scrape them, and you have to boil water, and the water has to be boiling hot. You have to have sharp knives, and you pour the boiling water on the hog. You lay it on a pallet or something where the water will drain off, and then you put the water in a small area until you can pull the hair out, and then you just scrape it with a knife until you scrape it clean.
Vina, what do you think of the pigs getting killed?
I saw how they hung them up. It had a little bone in there, and they hooked it like a little hook on it, and they yanked it up. They did both of the feet like that. I saw blood coming from its neck because they cut it under it, and there was big globs of blood that got stuck in there, and if they didn't stab it, then there would be big globs of the blood that they couldn't get out of it. So I'm helpful that they stabbed it because I didn't want globs of blood in the meat. They looked pretty nasty, but then I got to see the ham, and they had a big long strip. I think it was about 1 foot long. It just brings you food, and if you didn't kill pigs, then you wouldn't have no breakfast, no sausage or ham or bacon.
Ooh, let's see, I'm 43 years old now. I'd say since I was 12 years old, my dad's showed me. Just my dad and then other people just watching and stuff, that's how you learn things. It's something to keep going, you know. Like today I had my son and daughter down there and they watched us and stuff, you know. And it's just something to keep going. But yeah, it's a fact of life, you know. I like fresh meat and, you know, I know where it's coming from.
This is Sarah Kraft from Macon, Kentucky, reporting for the Appalachian Media Institute and Apple Shop's community radio station, WMMT 88.7.
That piece was produced during the Appalachian Media Institute's Youth Audio Lab in 2009. Next up, we hear some current farming news from southeastern Kentucky. WMMT reporter Sydney Bowles brings us an update on Letcher County's Kane Commercial Kitchen.
Across Appalachia, communities are searching for economic opportunities that aren't tied to coal. One industry that's showing promise is agriculture. But how do communities help small farmers grow their production? The recently opened Kane Kitchen in Whitesburg, Kentucky has some ideas. It's steamy and hot in the industrial kitchen in the old Whitesburg High School. Joyce Pinson wears a hairnet under a white baseball cap as she spoons bright red jelly into a glass jar. Joyce and her husband Charlie run Friends Drift Inn Farm in nearby Pike County. Joyce says she's been making jams and jellies for a long time.
I used to compete in 4-H, so that was back when I was 9 and I'm 50 something.
So you've been doing this for a while?
A long time.
Yeah.
But today is special. Here's Charlie.
And can you tell me what you're doing here today?
Doing some test runs for some commercial jams and jellies.
The Pinsons are sending their jams off to the Kentucky Food Safety Branch, the agency that tests food quality for all the goods manufactured in Kentucky. And if that agency says their jams meet food safety standards, the Pinsons will be able to sell in grocery stores and specialty shops all across the state. It could take up to 8 weeks for the Pinsons to hear back from the Food Safety Branch. So in the meantime, I talked to Valerie Eisenhorn, one of the people who helped create Kane. She says the kitchen may be new, but it's a part of a movement that's been around a whole lot longer.
The agricultural movement has been happening for several years in Letcher County, beginning about 7 years ago at Cowan Community Action Group with a Grow Appalachia program that is hosted there through Berea College. And that is not to say that Letcher County has not had a strong agricultural emphasis over the years and has a population that is very interested and has a history of agriculture with them, whether they're active or not. But my role and the role that led to this kitchen began with the Grow Appalachia program at Cowan Community Action Group.
Horn says as soon as the farmers had some support, they started producing way more food than they could use themselves. That started the idea for the Letcher County Farmers Market, which got off the ground in 2013.
The first year sales at the farmers market were roughly $6,000 in produce sold. This past year, when we haven't finished 2018, but 2017, produce sales were at least $139,000.
Still, Letcher County ranks among the worst counties in the state for overall health outcomes, which includes access to healthy foods. The county is also looking for new ways to diversify the economy in an age when banking on coal seems like more of a risk than it used to. Enter Kane Kitchen. Kane stands for Community Agriculture and Nutritional Enterprises, and the idea is to solve two problems at once. Help farmers build sustainable businesses and improve health outcomes by increasing access to healthy foods. The Kitchen is a partnership between the nonprofit health center Mountain Comprehensive Health Corporation and the Community Farm Alliance, a nonprofit that advocates for sustainable food and fiber networks. Besides providing a space for farmers to produce value-added goods, Kane also offers a party rental space, healthy cooking classes, and meals for low-income families. Horn says none of this would have worked without a strong desire from the community.
I give a lot of credit to our community, that we have a community that is excited and eager for opportunities for healthy foods. I don't think we're that different from the population in the nation, that we recognize that there are the impact that our food choices place on our health, and folks are looking for some alternatives that they can feel good about. For a number of reasons with produce here. The better food, better quality of the food, control over that, plus we're supporting growers in the community to create some income for that.
Kane opened earlier this year, and it's already helping another family expand their business. Seth and Cheryl Long run Southdown Farms in Whitesburg, Kentucky. On a recent afternoon, I caught up with Cheryl and four of her children making applesauce at Kane.
Can you explain to me what you're doing right now?
So basically, we cook down the apples, and so now they're soft and mushy, and then this squeezer sort of, it separates the seeds, and it has a screen on it so that, like, the seeds and thicker skins go out the end, but the juice and stuff that can come through the screen goes out into the sauce.
That's Reuben. He's 15. While he and his sister Helen, who's 13, strain boiled apples to get out all the tough bits, their older sister Hannah scoops hot, smooth applesauce into glass jars. Mom Cheryl says she sees the business as a way to give her kids valuable work experience. She doesn't need to get state certified and sell in big grocery stores. That's not the point.
Southdown Farms, motto on our jars is from our holler to your table. So it's not, we're not necessarily seeing how big and how huge we can get because there's the personalness of, at the farmer's market, there's the personalness of knowing who your product is going to. So I'm not sure how that's all going to work out, but we have really enjoyed the farmer's market and knowing our customers and working right with our customers.
Instead, Cheryl says Kane is helping her family produce way more than they ever could at home.
There's 7 bushels of apples. Yeah, that one there is a mixture of Ida Red and Honeycrisp.
And then how much more can you do here than you can do
at
home?
Oh, that's hardly comparable because you can't even fit a bushel in my big pots.
Wow.
So you got 7 bushel in there that's heated up and ready to go. And at home, we've got big pots, but they don't hold a bushel, so.
Kane is a pretty new operation, and questions remain about what will happen down the road. Will Kane help farmers like the Pinsons and the Longs turn their farms into full-time businesses? Will farmers be able to attract and retain customers to support these value-added goods? But kitchen manager Brandon Fleming says the community already has big plans for this space, especially during holiday season.
We also, as a commercial kitchen, you are, as an individual, can come in and use that space. Let's say you have a bumper crop of peppers or a bumper crop of whatever you would like to preserve for later use. You can come in and rent our space and use the larger facility to do that in a shorter amount of time. We also can work with you, and through the proper licenses and things, you can also offer your product then for sale at a larger supermarket, which is something now that you can't do from home without all the proper, with all the rules and regulations. You know, it has to be done in a commercial kitchen. So you can come in and reserve that space, and then you can sell online even as well as in a supermarket. And then also we have a large facility, one of the largest facilities in the area, that you can come in and rent just the space out for a wedding, a birthday party, a shower, or what have you, you know, just as the space.
Charlie Pinson, the jam maker we met earlier, he and Joyce still haven't heard back from the state about whether they're certified to sell in grocery stores. But he says all this is about more than just growing the business. It's about heritage.
That's one of the things that you'll find in Appalachia, is everybody in Appalachia went out, picked their own berries, and made their own jams and jellies for the winter. That's just a tradition.
For WMMT, I'm Sydney Bowles in Whitesburg, Kentucky.
You're listening to Mountain News on WMMT. We just heard a recent update on the Kane Commercial Kitchen in Whitesburg, Kentucky. For the remainder of this episode, we'll hear three pieces from the Ohio Valley Resource. The first focuses on state policies across the region that restrict the expansion of renewable energy sources like solar. Then, we learn about record-breaking rates of sexually transmitted infections across the U.S. And last, we'll hear about some ideas for how to clean up and repurpose abandoned mine lands throughout Central Appalachia.
A recent Consumer Reports survey found more than 75% of Americans think it's a worthy goal to increase renewable energy. And in states where coal-fired generation dominates, adding more renewable energy could be good for both the environment and the economy. But as Brittany Patterson reports, across the Ohio Valley, state policies are shading out solar power.
When Jenny and Brian Cayley decided to move to a family farm in Preston County, West Virginia, they thought a lot about what type of farmers they wanted to be.
We decided to come here and be in charge and do the farming. We went ahead and made a list of values, and one of those values was to minimize our fossil fuel use.
Installing solar panels was high on their wish list. And after 2 years of planning, earlier this fall, Possum Tail Farm began running on sunshine.
So it's up on top of the roof. It's 52 panels. I did crawl up there to check it out once, and I will not do it again. I'll leave that to the professionals.
The Cayleys decided on an 18-kilowatt solar array, which now powers their home and farm storefront. Anything extra they produce gets credited to their power bill. But while going solar was in line with their values, figuring out how to pay for the system was no easy task. The Cayleys qualified for a federal grant that covered a quarter of the installation costs and a low-interest loan from the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Without each of those, it would have been impossible for us financially.
One thing that wasn't available to them, help from the state of West Virginia.
We offer very few, if any, incentives. I think we're at a big disadvantage compared to our neighbors.
Jamie Van Ostren is the director of West Virginia University's Center for Energy and Sustainable Development. He says across the Ohio Valley, state adoption of solar incentives and pro-solar policies looks like a patchwork quilt. And as a result, not only is it harder to afford a solar system, but experts say the region could be missing out on huge economic benefits. And consumers have few options to combat rising power costs.
If customers are able to get their own solar, that's a hedge against rising electricity costs. You're going to be able to generate your own electricity and pay your utility less because you're basically buying fewer electrons.
Experts say there are two policies states can adopt that can incentivize solar installation, a renewable portfolio standard, and allowing third-party solar installation. Most of the region's states have one or both, but West Virginia and Kentucky have neither. A renewable portfolio standard, or RPS, requires electric utilities to get a certain percentage of electricity from renewable sources. That creates a demand for renewable energy and can improve the economics of solar installation. Autumn Long is program director of the nonprofit West Virginia Solar United Neighbors.
So in states with strong renewable portfolio standards, solar owners are actually able to sell the green value of that solar energy through a system called solar renewable energy credits. And they can be very valuable in states with robust renewable portfolio standards.
When states allow private, third-party developers to install solar systems, it can make it easier for schools, churches, and local governments to afford them.
A power purchase agreement allows them to install solar with zero upfront cost, potentially lower their energy bills from day one.
While Ohio allows these kinds of arrangements, Kentucky does not. And in West Virginia, third-party development is actually illegal.
Wong says, as a result, job opportunities could be at stake.
The solar industry is blowing up.
Solar installer is the single fastest growing job in the country. And employment data show states like Kentucky and West Virginia are lagging behind their neighbors.
The demand for this job is just skyrocketing.
And some hope the Ohio Valley could become the next manufacturing hub for the industry. That's how Dan Sawmiller sees it. He directs energy policy for the Natural Resources Defense Council in Ohio and has been working to convince regulators to allow utility American Electric Power to build a huge solar project.
It's an opportunity to show the benefit for these kinds of communities like you find in Ohio and in Kentucky and in West Virginia, to show that, you know, clean energy can provide economic benefit while also protecting the environment, lowering costs for electricity customers, and the list goes on.
He says the hope is that this 400 megawatt commitment could convince solar panel makers and other manufacturers to set up shop here. Back at the farm, the Cayleys are quick to note installing their solar system was also a good investment, despite the lack of state-level incentives. Brian says if energy prices remain steady, the system will pay for itself in about 15 years. If prices rise, they make out sooner.
The life of the system is 25, 30 years. And so there's a lot of time there yet in that future that then becomes all free energy, essentially.
By his count, his rate of return is a sunny 7% or more, better than investing in the stock market. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Brittany Patterson.
Health officials across the country are tracking record-breaking rates of sexually transmitted disease. That includes a resurgence of diseases that had become rare, such as syphilis. Mary Meehan reports that as STD cases rise, public health budgets to combat them are falling.
Matt Pryor is the spokesperson for the nonprofit National Coalition of STD Directors. They are the folks on the front lines. He says STDs are a public health crisis, especially in parts of Appalachia already struggling with an opioid epidemic.
You know, we're seeing syphilis and other STD outbreaks associated with the opioid crisis, and states that are particularly hard hit by the opioid crisis are in states that are particularly hard hit by the STD epidemic.
People between the ages of 15 and 25 have the highest rates of STDs. Pryor says he finds a recent report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention especially troubling. It showed a rise in infant deaths as more newborns contract syphilis from their mothers during birth. Pryor stresses that STDs, if diagnosed early, can be treated effectively. He ties a rising infant death toll to decreased funding for public health.
Essentially a failure of the public health system. And a failure of our nation, we should not see mothers and children dying. Essentially, very easily treatable, identifiable diseases.
While STDs have increased by 30% in the last 5 years to reach an all-time high, the amount of federal money for prevention and education has consistently gone down since 2003. Pryor says that federal funding is critical for states like Kentucky, West Virginia, and Ohio.
The federal STD prevention line is the only STD prevention line or funding stream that these states have.
Jim Thacker is the spokesperson for the Madison County Health Department. He says public health officials expect spikes in infectious disease, but the recent resurgence of chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis is something different. Overall, the CDC reported 2.4 million new cases of those diseases in 2017. Thacker says a handful of cases in Madison County reflected a 300% jump in syphilis.
It's frightening any time that you see something come back that you thought we had under control.
Not only under control, but in the case of syphilis, essentially eradicated for more than 50 years. Thacker adds that discussing sexually transmitted disease makes people uncomfortable.
It's something that a lot of people don't want to talk about.
Thacker says part of the increase could be linked to a lack of fear of HIV among people born after the AIDS epidemic. That and effective long-term birth control makes condom use seem less urgent to teens and young adults. Eastern Kentucky University student Priscilliana Kaywood is an exception to that trend.
I personally like to keep myself updated on all of that stuff. On my personal social media, I follow like the CDC, and various health departments.
The infectious disease major and daughter of a straight-talking nurse has been the friend. She's the one among her peers that friends turn to for information about STDs. It's a role she's played since middle school. She understands it's common for people to push their sexual boundaries, but that can have consequences.
Some people take extreme advantage of that and then just end up with a disease that they don't want or never intended to get because A, they didn't know, all the facts. B, they just were careless.
Kay Wood is also an intern at the Lexington Fayette County Health Department, where she sometimes assists with testing. She understands there can be a mental block to getting tested.
You need to know the answer, but you don't want to know it.
But she says knowing can make all the difference when it comes to your sexual health. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Mary Meehan.
A new report has identified 20 ready-made projects across the Ohio Valley that could help clean up and repurpose abandoned coal mine sites. Brittany Patterson has more.
Solar farms in Virginia, a green energy subdivision in Kentucky, 88 miles of mountain biking trails in Ohio, and a meat processing plant in West Virginia. These are just some of the projects that could be undertaken on abandoned coal mine sites across the Ohio Valley, according to a new report by a coalition of regional advocacy groups called Reclaiming Appalachia Coalition. The report outlines 20 projects already in the making that, if funded, could give abandoned mining operations that were never cleaned up a second life. The group argues well-thought-out reclamation projects can spur economic development. The idea has gotten a boost in recent years. Congress appropriated more than $100 million in both 2017 and 2018 for the Abandoned Mineland Pilot Program. Combined, the report's authors say the 20 projects would require about $38 million worth of investment, but would bring more than $44 million in economic activity and about 540 jobs to the region. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Brittany Patterson.
That's it for this episode of Mountain News. Music on this show features Shelby County, Kentucky's own John Herod with a fiddle tune called Hog in the Red Bresh. That song was released on Herod's new album, Johnny Come Along, in the summer 2018 by Appleshop's own June Apple Records. If you liked what you heard and want to listen to this or previous episodes of Mountain News again, you can find them on our website at wmmt.org or download Mountain News as a podcast from SoundCloud or Stitcher. I've been your host, Marley Green. And from all of us at WMMT, thanks for listening to Real People Radio.
This has been Mountain News and World Report, a production of WMMT-FM, Mountain Community Public Radio, the non-commercial broadcast service of the world-famous Apple Shop in Whitesburg, Kentucky.